For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
Good morning and welcome. I'm delighted to introduce our guest speaker for this morning. Sarah Weintraub is the Executive Director of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, a national, I guess international organization of Buddhists working on engaged social action in all kinds of different ways. And is new to that from the last several months. Sarah's going to talk about her experiences in Colombia as a witness in combat zones, I guess, and talking about joy during wartime, which is, I think, very relevant for all of us. It's not as easy to realize, but we are all living during wartime, so I think it's very relevant. I'm particularly delighted to introduce Sarah as. Sarah grew up in San Francisco Zen Center, and her parents, Steve and Linda, are old friends and mentors of mine. Linda is the former abbess of San Francisco Zen Center. So Sarah, we figured out yesterday, was like 2 or 3 years old when she lived next to me my first year at Tassajara Monastery. So it's delightful to have you here in this new capacity, and thank you very much for coming.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone.
Good morning.
I wanted to start by thanking you, Tygon, so much for inviting me to be here. And for all of you, also, for inviting me to be here, so to speak, by coming here. And I'm really just thrilled and delighted to be here and to have this opportunity to speak. So thank you. I wanted to start by telling you a little bit about me and my kind of trajectory, my background, which Tygon introduced a little bit also. My name is Sarah Weintraub. I grew up at the San Francisco Zen Center community in Northern California, and my parents are both teachers, and that was kind of the waters I was swimming in as I grew up, of Buddhist teaching and of communal living. And I didn't pay much attention to it particularly and wasn't particularly interested in Buddhist teaching or practice. It was like what was going on and that's fine. And I was doing my own thing, busy doing my own things. So that was my kind of childhood experience. As an adult, I worked after studying at the university. I went to Colombia, South America, where I lived for about 3 years, and 3 years full-time, and then going back since then. And I worked with a project run by the Fellowship of Reconciliation that is a project in accompaniment, which is a particular strategy for protecting the human rights of people who are working for peace. There's a civil war in Colombia. It's the longest running civil war in the world. Started in 1948. And many civilians are caught in the crossfire and also are actually targeted for their work for peace and justice and their work that doesn't cooperate with either side of the civil war, either side of the kind of war making, and they're often attacked for that. So I lived in a small community in northwestern Colombia, a very rural area, offering presence as protection. That's the strategy of accompaniment. So we lived there in the community, and by actually being there and by representing the international concern for this peace community, the peace community was safer than it would have been otherwise. The people, their lives and their work for peace are protected in that way. And the project is still going on. So that was kind of like the well, one of the most extremely formative experiences of my life living there in Colombia with that peace community. And I also lived in the capital doing other work kind of along the same themes, but with a wider focus than just that particular community. And by the time I finished, I had a contract and then I extended it and I extended it. And by the time I left Colombia, I was very, very, very tired, you know, burnt out and overextended and had been working really hard in this very difficult realm where there were a lot of people suffering a lot. And, you know, we were doing this work of protection, but not everyone could be protected always. So I left Colombia kind of pretty wrecked, and I decided to go to Tasajara, which is the mountain monastery in central California that the San Francisco Zen Center has. So I decided to go there to kind of rest. That was the idea, to rest and recharge and be in this beautiful, safe place. And I thought, sure, Buddhist practice, that'll probably be good too. You know, a little bit of meditation will be good too. So I went there, and then I ended up, I went there in order to be in Tasajara, to be in this beautiful place. But then part of the commitment, if you are living at Tasajara, is that you do the practice and you sit. And I entered that kind of, wholeheartedly, like, what's this about? And I found it very nourishing and relieving and caring. It was caring for me through doing the practice, but just through doing it, I found that I didn't. So then for the next few years, I lived mostly at Tasajara and also going back to Colombia with various creative and political projects that I continued to work on, and also being some in the Bay Area. So kind of back and forth between those places. And I had this kind of vision of it at a certain point of Colombia as like one end of the pendulum and Tasajara is the other, and like swinging back and forth through just realms, you know, through different worlds. Had this feeling that somehow these two extremes of Colombia life and Tasajara life were balancing each other. And someone, a teacher at Tasajara, the abbot of San Francisco Zen Center, Paul Haller, said at a certain point, describing something else, but it resonated for me, the medicine and the disease cure each other. So I don't know if I can say exactly what that means, but my sense of it is that the medicine and the disease cure each other, and activist work in Colombia and Buddhist practice at Tasajara have been curing each other, have been curing each other. And which one is the medicine and which one is the disease? They're both completely related. In some sense, I was so burnt out after Colombia and being at Tasajara, I'm doing a lot better now. So I was cured in some way. And on the other side, it was my work in Colombia and my connections there and my loving relationships there that gave life and vibrancy to my practice at Tasajara. So, yeah. So that's a little bit about me and where I come from, so to speak, which I thought would be helpful in orienting you all to what I'm going to continue talking about, which is joy. And I chose to speak about that because it feels like very important to me, like very central. Like, what do I want to talk about? What do I like to think about and experience is joy. And joy in our practice and joy in our lives. I I've been working kind of more actively with this idea of joy and what does it mean and what is it and how do we express it, particularly for the last year or so. And I wanted to tell you how this particular cycle started. I was back in Colombia last year working on a film, working on a documentary film with a good friend of mine, a film about youth resistance to war and to violence, both youth in the U.S. and in Colombia, and kind of how they are working in resistance to the militarism that's being given to them. So we were there in Colombia, and we were with this group of young people, both Americans and Colombians, who were sharing with each other and learning from each other and exchanging strategies and learning about each other's lives. And really the Colombians being in a situation of war and the Americans being in various violent situations. Some of them came from neighborhoods that had a lot of gang violence and other situations. So we were with this group, and the Colombian group that was hosting us is this just incredible, incredible and incredibly lively group of Colombian youth in the city of Medellin, which is the second largest city in Colombia, and it's my favorite city. And I'd worked with them with this youth group called the Red Juvenil, which means the youth network. So I'd worked with them for many years. And since I started working in Colombia, we'd collaborated on various projects. So it was this very high energy, exciting time, you know, with these American kids and then the kids from Medellin, and their sharing and exchanging ideas and learning about each other's lives. And it was like from early in the morning to late at night. And then I was there with my co-producer filming the whole thing. So we're filming and then, you know, when we have a spare moment, interviewing people. And so this was the situation that we were in, and working, you know, working from early until late. And the delegation had been going for about a week at that point. It was like a 12-day trip. So to get around to what happened, that was this particular kind of trigger for this cycle. So we had a kind of evening off where the Red Juvenil, the youth group in Medellin, kids planned to give us an evening off so we could kind of rest. So we ended at, you know, 8:30 at night instead of at like midnight, so that there could be some resting. And so I and my co-producer, Corey, who's my good friend, we were like, oh, great, we have an evening off. We can finally do some of these interviews we need to do. And, you know, we were like ready to really make good use of our evening. And we ended up interviewing me because we didn't want to bother anyone else, kind of let them rest. So we interviewed me for about, I don't know, an hour or more and did various other things for the film. So the next morning, we went into the Red Juvenil office, and I saw my friend Patricia, who's one of the people who works there, one of the young people who I've known for many years. And she said, oh, how was your night off? How was your rest? And I said something like, oh, you know, we couldn't really take a night off. I mean, the delegation is so short. We have not very much time. So, you know, we ended up working on the film, and that's fine, you know. And she said something, and it's funny because this was such a powerful experience in my life. And I can't say exactly what it was that she said. I mean, it was in Spanish, furthermore. But she said something like, you know, when you don't rest, when you work like that, it's like you are recreating the same systems of oppression and patriarchy and, you know, Puritanism, basically, recreating those same systems internally that you're fighting externally. She said it more gently than that. I mean, she wasn't like attacking me, but she was just kind of like, huh. And it was so powerful for me. It was like, whoa, because here I was, you know, working for peace and justice and a change in these kind of systems of oppression and of workaholism and all of those patriarchy, those systems. And yet I had that feeling of incredible resonance that, yes, it's true. And in the meantime, that's what I'm doing with myself, on myself, you know, telling myself to work harder. And so that, it kind of like broke something open for me. And I thought, I want to and need to enjoy my life. Here I am doing this project, this wonderful film that I love, and I'm not really enjoying it. I'm sort of like trying to cross it off my to-do list, you know, but it's my project of joy and love and passion. That's why I'm doing it. So that kind of shifted something for me, and I started looking for opportunities to continue to work with that and think about that and express that. So I've been working with this for a while. And then, yes, and which connects to this kind of very Colombian phrase, which is, no nos vinimos para que nos maltratemos, which means we didn't come here to mistreat ourselves. And that actually mistreating ourselves is the opposite of how to help. You know, it's like kind of save all beings, including this one. That kind of idea, right? So, and in working with this, I came upon a quote from Suzuki Roshi, who is the founder of the San Francisco Zen Center, and great teacher, Suzuki Roshi. And what he said was exactly what I was trying to say, or what I've been trying to say. So I want to share this quote with you that I feel like deepens and takes a step further what I've been working with here. So this is from a talk that he gave, you know, many years ago. I don't know what year it was, but the late 60s probably. The most important thing to do for others is not to build something beautiful for others or help them in some materialistic way or formal way, but to help others by giving true spirit of how to live in this world and true understanding of our life. So the most important thing is not to do something, but to give true spirit, to give true spirit of how to live in this world and true understanding of our life. And he goes on to say, of course, as long as we live, or as long as we have this body, it is not possible to get out of suffering. It is not possible to get out of suffering. So the point is how to change our suffering into joy of life, true joy of life. How to change our suffering into joy. This is how to help others. Without this point, we cannot help others in its true sense. This is how to help others. Without this point, we cannot help others in its true sense. If you have this understanding, whatever you do, almsgiving or kind words or loving words, will work. So the point is how to change our suffering into joy of life, true joy of life. This is how to help others. Without this point, we cannot help others in its true sense. If you have this understanding, whatever you do, almsgiving or kind words or loving words will work. So how do we change our suffering into joy? I mean, what's that? And my suspicion about it, my intuition or my understanding of it is that we change our suffering into joy by not changing it. That is, by staying with it, exactly as it is, and letting it change itself. And I think that's what we do actually here in Zazen. You know, when we sit, we're not changing anything. We're letting things come and go, and letting things be and change themselves as they do, you know. And I'm sitting here and I'm first, my heart is beating, and then it's, you know, slowing down, or I'm feeling very alert and pleased, and then I'm feeling very sleepy and things change. And when we're sitting, we kind of maybe we notice it a little bit more. And we also are training. We're also training through our sitting in letting things alone and letting things be as they are. And not just in our sitting, but in our you know, Zazen mind as we carry it forth into our other activities. And as we do the next thing, carrying that idea of not changing things, but letting the next thing change and letting our suffering change into joy. And I have a story about this that happened right around the same, a few weeks later after the delegation was over and I was back in Medellin. And I had a very clear experience of just this, even though I didn't know that was what was happening at the time. So I was back in Medellin, the delegation is over, everyone had left. And I was, this one day I was staying with a friend of mine and she wasn't there. And I was just, you know, like in a, just a terrible mood. Like I didn't want to do anything and I didn't like anyone and I didn't want to talk to anyone. And it was like, ugh, just in general. And I was sitting there on the bed thinking, first of all, I was thinking I should be having fun. This should be, here I am in Medellin. I love Medellin. It's like my favorite city. I should be calling my friends. I should be doing something, but I don't want to do anything. And then it was like, maybe I should go for a walk. Maybe I should go for a run. Maybe I should, if I drank a cup of coffee, maybe I would feel alert again. And, you know, thinking, how can I change this uncomfortable, like, kind of mood? And I was going through all these options and I didn't really want to do anything. And then it kind of occurred to me, I thought, or I could just be unhappy. It's like I don't have to necessarily change it. I could just be unhappy. And so I thought, I'm just going to be unhappy. And I laid there on the bed and I was so miserable. And I just was fully, you know, for no reason, but that was what was going on because that happens sometimes, just fully unhappy and miserable. And then eventually it did change and it did move into something else. And I went on and, you know, continued with my day. But I had a feeling about that was sort of like, like passive Zazen, you know? I didn't think I'm going to sit Zazen, but I thought I'm just going to lay here and be. And that was what was happening. However, so this idea of changing by accepting things as they are, not necessarily approving of them, but accepting that this is the case, right? And at the same time, we want to change things. I mean, we are working for change, right? Most of us, in some form or another, whether we want to change our internal lives or whether we're out there in social movements and, you know, trying to end the war in Colombia or whatever else we're doing, we're working for change. So how to hold these two pieces? How to hold this of both not trying to change things and letting things be as they are, whether we're talking about our minds or the world, and at the same time, changing. We want to change things. That's important to us. So how to hold these two pieces? And I think that this is actually our paradox. This is how we exist, is in trying to hold these two pieces, because we are trying to change things. And I think with this paradox, it's like accepting me the way that I am, and my mind the way that it is, and the world the way that it is the starting point for changing it. But we have to see it first. We have to see, we have to carefully explore the causes and conditions. We have to see what's going on. And if we're trying to change it before we see it, or if we don't want to feel it, so we're going to do something else before we even see what's there, then that's not as strong of a starting point. But if we have this starting point of, well, here it is, what is it? Then that gives us some place to start for what is it and moving forward into what else can it be. I think that that's the piece that, you know, we talk about wisdom and compassion and action, right? Those are kind of like some of the bodhisattva ideals, or the sort of archetypal imagery and ideas that we're moved by. And I think that there's the wisdom and the compassion, and then the action. And, or I often think of it as like, you know, the wisdom, the carefully observing, and the compassion as the two legs. And then we can walk on those two legs of wisdom and compassion, and that brings forth the action of what action to take. What action to take to change the circumstances of the world. But it has to start with that. My sense of it is, that's what I think, that it has to start with the wisdom and the compassion. And then from that, we have the two legs for walking. And then as we're walking, the Zapatistas in southern Mexico say, walking, we listen. So we start out walking, but we're still listening. We're still listening so that we can change and go on to and continue walking. So this idea of really seeing ourselves and our lives and the world, and it's very painful. There's a lot of suffering when we really see, when we're really open to it, when we're really showing up for it. There's a lot of pain and there's a lot of suffering when we show up for our whole lives. And there is also joy. When we show up for our whole lives, we can show up fully for the joy that's there. And I have kind of, for me, it's almost like archetypal imagery of what that is, to show up fully for the fullness of our lives. I think about the village that I lived in northern Colombia. The village is called La Unión, and it's located in a very strategic region in the Colombian conflict. So it's a hot zone, it's a war zone, and really terrible violence has happened there. Just, you know, terrible, horrific kinds of violence have happened there. And it's also paradise. I mean, it's the most beautiful place. It's like green and green and green with like echoing different shades of green. Kind of like, I mean, it's not rainforest, but it's like tropical forest kind of feeling. And the people and the families and babies, and people have chickens and pigs and cows. And it's just like, I mean, it's like abundance. It's like paradise kind of feeling of abundance. And there is this, this real darkness there. And I would go out into the fields up in the mountains with people from the village, and they would point out, you know, this is where Eduardo was killed, right here in front of this tree, you know, that kind of thing. So it was like, the land in that area is steeped in human suffering and violence. And it is so fertile and so vibrant. And there's so much, I mean, it's really like you spit out your papaya seeds and you have six papaya trees in your backyard, really. I mean, it's like that kind of feeling of life and death, and this fullness of life and death right next to each other, and so, so full. There was this one, actually this is very appropriate to talk about, because so this peace community was founded so that the people, the campesinos, the rural farmers, didn't want to side with one side or the other of the conflict, because both sides are very corrupt and terrible. And not that the people who are in, you know, the fighters are terrible. I think they're doing the best that they can for the most part. But the methods and the way the conflict plays out is really horrible. So, yes, and you're not allowed to not side with one side or the other. It's very much, if you're not with us, you're against us, right? So this peace community is very attacked. And they founded the peace community in order to work together in a community and be able to stay on their land and not displace from their land, which is extremely common in Colombia. It has one of the highest rates of displaced people in the world, who are basically refugees within their own country, but they're refugees because they had to leave their homes. So the peace community was founded in 1997 on March 23rd. So the anniversary just happened. And it's a very exciting time in the peace community. Every year there's a big celebration for the anniversary of, like, we're still here, we're still doing this. You know, no one knew how long this kind of experiment in nonviolent living would be able to last in the midst of a Colombian war zone. And they're still there, and they're still doing well, and they're still also very threatened. So I was at a celebration for the anniversary of the peace community in 2005. We were at this celebration, and the way they decided to celebrate the anniversary of the peace community was there was this, they invited people from all over Colombia, from different movements, different peace movements, and indigenous people and women's groups from all over Colombia. And then a number of us internationals, you know, from international organizations were there. There were about 100 people. And we all hiked up deep, deep, deep into the mountains. I mean, way into the territory of the war, deep into the mountains, and exhumated the remains of three people who had been killed in a particular region. And they'd been killed years ago. They'd been killed maybe 10 or 15 years ago, but they had never had a proper burial because it was in the middle of the conflict, and these people had been killed, and then just, you know, the bodies were buried, but without ceremony. So the community, and with a close advisor of the community, a wonderful Catholic priest, Bodhisattva, named Padre Javier Giraldo, and he's kind of one of the visionaries of the community. So we all went up with Padre Javier and everyone up, you know, like 7 hours of hiking through the mud and exhumated these particular bodies. And it was, I mean, it was like, you know, a big hole, and Padre Javier down in the bottom of the hole, you know, pulling out bits of the remains that were left. So that was part of the celebration. And the people took the remains and then hiked down. We spent the night up there and then hiked down the next day down to La Union. And there was a funeral. So the remains were put in coffins and, you know, decorated with flowers, and in the middle of town under a kind of palm-thatched roof. And there was a funeral ceremony for them because they'd never had a funeral ceremony. And then they were taken to the La Union Cemetery, the little La Union Cemetery, and buried there. And then there was a baptism of 11 babies because, you know, the priest was visiting and there were babies who needed to be baptized. And it became this flurry of, you know, and the babies, and they're wearing these long white dresses, and then the other kids are pulling on the babies, and there's godparents, and I was godmother to a number of these babies, and signing things and lighting candles and you know, yelling and flowers, and it was this kind of exuberant celebration of life. So there was this exhumation and this funeral, and then this and then the baptism of 11 babies, which is a lot. So this is life. This is the fullness of life, you know? And my sense is that this is the true spirit of life, the true spirit of life that Suzuki Roshi was talking about, is that kind of breadth and depth and wideness to experience the funeral and the baptism on the same day, and, you know, within the same few hours, really, one after another. And this is actually suffering that turns into joy. There's one more thing that I wanted to share, which is, it's started as a poem, and then it became a song that was very popular. You may know it. It was very popular in Latin American kind of resistance singing, like Latin American folk music of the social change type of folk music, which is a particular genre. And I think this song is just exactly what I'm talking about. The author is Violeta Parra. Various people have sung the song. Mercedes Sosa, who recently died, was well known for it. It's called Gracias a la Vida. I'm not going to sing it. I'm just going to read it. It's a hard song to sing. Gracias a la vida. Thank you to life. Que me ha dado tanto. That has given me so much. Que me ha dado la risa. That has given me laughter. Y me ha dado el llanto. And has given me crying. Así yo distingo dicho de quebranto. That's how I tell apart good fortune from ruin. Los dos materiales que forman mi canto, the two materials that make up my song. Que es el canto de ustedes, que es el mismo canto. Which is the song of all of you, which is the same song. Que es el canto de todos, que es mi propio canto, which is the song of everyone, which is my own song. Gracias a la vida. Thank you to life. Gracias a la vida. Gracias a la vida. Gracias a todos ustedes. Thank you, all of you, very much.
Sarah, thank you so much for wonderful, beautiful Dharma talk, joy and suffering together. Yes.
Yes.
So if there's any questions for Sarah or responses or comments about any aspect of the joy or suffering that she's talking about in the practice of it, please feel free.
I just wanted to thank you for reminding me about the balance, because, you know, often you realize that in life when you go through certain periods, you realize the relationship, and it's that balance in which you find, I think, true joy. But at certain points, you can forget that balance. And thank you for reminding me.
You're welcome.
I'm struggling finding the part that is the action. I'm wondering kind of where you find that motivation, inspiration.
I think for me, it's taken different forms in my life, that kind of inspiration for action. I think when I first started working in Colombia, it had a lot to do with wanting to live and to experience, and kind of along the way to do something to help people, you know. But it really had to do with like me and my unfolding path of wanting to just fling myself up against the world and feel it, that kind of feeling. And then it changed. And I would say that now the inspiration is love. And I feel so connected to and so in love with Colombia and La Unión, the community that I lived with and the people there. And that kind of carried me through the really hard times, like when I was working in Bogota and was really burnt out. But I would have this kind of, I remember saying, I just don't want anyone in La Unión to ever be hurt again. And it was like, whatever I can do, wherever I best fit, wherever I'm most needed to prevent those, you know, 150 people who live in La Unión from being hurt again. That felt like the key. And I think that's still a big piece of it, even though it's taken so many twists and turns, you know, and I'm not directly working in service to those with those people now. I'm working in other ways, Colombia related, but So I think that that kind of inspiration for me comes from love, and that kind of like passion and joy. You know, thinking about particularly like making that film last year, it was like, what could be more joyful? What could be more fun and passionate, you know, than working on this in this creative way with people who I loved and getting to tell the story of other people who I loved? That was kind of where it came from. I think for me, kind of the tricky part is here, this project comes up and out of my heart and out of my passion for life. And then it like comes up and then it lands on the to-do list. And then it's like, oh, gotta get rid of it, you know, kind of feeling. So it's like, that's something that I struggle with. But I think, actually we had a meeting here yesterday, a meeting for the BPF, the Buddhist Peace Fellowship chapter. And there was something that one of the members of the chapter, a great teacher named Jack Lawler, said that really resonated with me, where we were talking about how to inspire more people to be involved in the activities of the chapter, the peacemaking kind of piecework activities of the chapter. And he said, well, it has to be fun. It has to be like people want to go and hang out with their friends and, you know, be a part of a community that's working in activist work. And I thought, yes, that's really important. Because if it's like, oh, another thing that I have to do now, I have to go to this meeting or this protest or this, I have to, you know, go to the prison to teach people or whatever activist work one is doing, if it feels like another thing, then that's what it is. Then it's like another thing and it's a burden. But finding the kind of joy and excitement, and I think a lot of that is connection with other people and the sangha of working on things together. So those are some of my thoughts about that.
Sarah, maybe you could say just a little bit more about, you know, now that you've come back from working in this war zone and from being up in the mountains in Tassajara, which I don't know if it's a peace zone, but whatever, in your new position as executive director of Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and the Chicago chapter meets here monthly. But how do you see your new position in terms of joy and war and this process that we all have some relationship to in our practice? Could you say just a little bit
more? So my feeling about it is, you know, I was talking about that pendulum, kind of like swinging back and forth from Colombia to Tassajara and swinging through all the realms of my life. And then my feeling is that the pendulum has sort of, it's still the same thing, you know, it's still the same work and the same intention, but it's kind of quieted now. It's not going quite as far into the depths of the conflict zone or into the depths of the practice life. And it's sort of here in the middle in Oakland where I live and work now. And that feels very right to me. That feels very accurate and actually where I want to be and what I want to be doing. But that it really is, so I work for the Buddhist Peace Fellowship. I'm the director of the Buddhist Peace Fellowship, and that is an organization that is dedicated to working for peace and justice, but from a perspective of interconnectedness, from a Buddhist perspective, rather than a kind of separation or demonizing, you know? It's that founded with and devoted to the idea of exactly actually what I'm talking about today, of working for change, but in a way that that comes from this truth of impermanence and of interconnectedness and of, you know, if I had been born into another life, I too would be carrying a gun through the Colombian jungles, right? But I was born into this life, and so I'm going to do all that I can to stop those people with the guns from hurting the people who I love. That's my path. That's the life that I have. So I feel like Buddhist Peace Fellowship as a vehicle is such a wide and beautiful vehicle for really bringing these two life streams of mine and of ours, I think, into conversation with each other, of the activist stream and the Buddhist stream, and what do they have to say to each other, and how do they relate to each other, and that through the various projects of BPF and the various ways of working, that's a way to explore that and to deepen it, and also the sense that I have is to also manifest it, like I was just saying to Dean yesterday, I feel like I'm now in this job, I am being called upon to embody all this that I've been talking about living joyfully while doing social change work, being called on to embody it in a very public way. I've been working on it. That's been up for a long time. But now I feel like as director of this organization, it's like, I feel like I actually have to show that, yes, you can do social change work and not burn out. You can do it in a way that's healthy and sustainable. And for me, Buddhist practice is a big part of that and is a support to that. So I've been suspecting this for a long time, and now it's like, okay, show it, do it. I've been in the position for about 4 months now. And I think I'll be here for another little while. So, yeah, it's pretty wonderful to have this opportunity.